Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It's time to move the ConnectNet, which has been around for, would you believe it, 32 years. This will be TechNet number 1,554 of the series that began in September of 1982. You'll also be hearing John, KC2WGB, who monitors EchoLink and handles the mailbag for people who don't have the ability to talk to us directly yet. You'll hear later on Paul, WS2N, a space expert, will be giving us a space report number, well, I'm going to guess it's number 146 of the series. Along the way, you'll be periodically hearing Hal, K6DBZ, who has a lot of experience with a lot of radio equipment, and he gives the so-called compact answer, which, of course, I sometimes stretch out. So, TechNet, let me drop it. The TechNet is a gathering of curious people who appreciate what wireless radio can do, what wireless techniques can do, what radio can do, action at a distance. Kind of amazing to many people. I'm one of them. You could be running a QRP transmitter. You press down on that key on Long Island, and a man 8,000 miles away hears what you're doing. And by Morse code, you and he are communicating with each other. Well, there are similar things that go on with satellite radio. The curious people are the ones that want to know how it all works, how to make it work better. They gather here, and they help each other. And every bit of what you hear is going to be 100% accurate all the time. We all make some errors. But you could say the material presented here is a kind of peer-reviewed material, because everything that gets said gets recorded, and you can play it back on a website. That website is mymontechnet.com is one of the websites. The main website that has the recordings is amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor has 6 or 7 years, thousands of hours of recording of TechNet. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it's in 4 reels or 5 reels of 1 hour each. And so you can play back all of this material. People do that. And when John and I and Hal and Paul make any mistake, they let us know about it real soon, and the next week it gets corrected. My job. An interesting meeting took place this week at Brookhaven Town Hall in Farmingville concerning a cell site that has been under contest since roughly 2009. The zoning board of Brookhaven Town approved a zoning tower installation or modification way back in 2009. So the third or fourth of a series of meetings where T-Mobile made presentations to the town to try to conserve and try to calm their fears and angers. That meeting took place last Wednesday. I attended that, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. An amazing situation from my point of view. Let's see. The way a person signs into the technical net, because he does have a question or a comment, is to give that group of four guys your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening, so you don't have to sign in telling us you're listening. We sort of assume that by now. Let me drop. And when I do pass it back to a person, quite often they get quite excited, and they want to make sure that they transmit at the right time, and they forget to wait for the four beeps, in which case this whole communication system doesn't get properly reset and it times out. Let's see, there is a, I'm checking on it right now, sure enough, there's a beautiful repeater out of the east end of Long Island that's linked to this one, the 147-375 machine. Some people sign in by that, and I think that's the one that connects to the EchoLink. By EchoLink, you have trouble signing in because we don't give a big enough gap. By letting yourself, letting that be known, and you can send messages to John, KC2WGB, who monitors that website, and we find out real fast that somebody's been trying to get an edge in WordWise and hasn't succeeded in doing it, and then we correct that condition. Okay, time for us to take check-ins for those who do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2MMY, Ray, yes.
WHYY, Joe, yes.
And those are two very good examples of people signing in just right. Call letters and name and the word yes. So we know that Ray and Joe, one of our frequent sign-ins, has a real question. Anyone else that would like to check in, because they do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
West to land, Paul, with a space report and a comment about that cell tower.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to that, Paul, because that took place in your town. In the town of Ronkonkoma is where this contested cell tower, so-called cell tower. In my opinion, it is not a cell tower of the normal kind. It's a kind that's considerably lower in visual appearance and radio characteristics as far as the neighborhood is concerned. But since you're heavily involved, well, about 40 it was probably the third of a series of meetings, and I showed up like a sore thumb immediately. They basically said, who are you and why are you here? So there's a whole story behind that. They recognized me right away as an outsider. I wasn't part of the 40 people who all know each other on a first name basis. So I think that's a few blocks from your home, Paul. I'd be interested to hear your comments on it. Maybe you've attended some of the previous meetings. You were not there at the one last Wednesday. Alrighty, anyone else to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet, give me a call that is a name right now. K2LIW. Okay, maybe people will sign in later. We got more than enough to get going. These guys in Yonkers and the Bronx, they really appreciate radio. So tell us a little bit about that, Ray, and what would you like to talk about? KC2MMY. K2LIW, you got it, Ray.
Hey, Dick, and good evening to the TechNet, and how you doing? My question is, I have a 10-meter RF amp, or 11-meter CB RF amp. Wondering if there's any way I can use that for 2-meter sideband. If there's a way to cheat, maybe I can put an antenna and tuner in between or something. And if not, maybe you can tell me why not. And that's the basic question, I think. Pretty good question. So thanks a lot.
KC2MMY,
back to you.
Yeah, I like that question, Ray. You've used some good common sense. That 11-meter or 10-meter amplifier has some nice number of watts of output, and it's solid state, ready to roll. Can I pour 2-meter signals through it at 144 megs? And I think the answer is about 98% no, Ray. If you've ever been involved with the design of a transistorized transmitter, and I've done that a few times in my life over the last 40 years of radio exposure as an engineer, you'll discover very rapidly that the transistor itself, the model number of the transistor you choose quite often is emphasized for a particular frequency region. That's one-third of the problem. Two-thirds of the problem is that you've got to put a very fancy impedance matching network on the input of the transistor, and a very fancy impedance matching network on the output of the transistor. In some transmitting transistors, the input impedance might be 5 ohms, and the output impedance might be 2 ohms. So there's a fancy network there, a filter-like network with high-power inductors and capacitors that matches the 50 ohms of input that you desire down to the 2 or 3 ohms that the transistor wants to see at its base. And that collector comes out with 3 ohms of impedance, and it's got to be stepped up to 50 ohms in the output. When you build a network that has that much of an impedance ratio, input to output, on the input end of that transistor and the output end of that transistor, those kinds of networks are usually a few percent wide in frequency coverage. And so to go from 28 or so megacycles up to 144 megacycles, about a 5-to-1 or a 6-to-1 frequency ratio. That's a 600% increase, so to speak, on a set of
repeater timeout.
On a set of inductors and capacitors that are a few percent broad at their desired frequency region of design. You can apply 2 meters at some small amount of power to that amplifier, and with your bird directional watt meter or any other kind of sensing equipment, find out what comes out. Most likely you'll do no damage, just that very little of the power will get to the transistor. It won't even get turned on. It'll probably have no gain. It'll probably have 10 or 15 decibels of loss instead of gain. So if you're of an experimental mind, it's worth a try. But the chances of success, I believe, are very low, Ray, for some of the reasons I've indicated. Now, the good news is that there are a number of 2-meter amplifiers, everything from 10 watts output to 1,000 watts of output, that are on eBay and HRO. You can buy it brand new, you can buy them used. So remember, I bought one, a used amplifier, that has 300 watts of capability on an afterburner amplifier on 2 meters. And the main thing that was wrong with it, why it was being sold at a flea market at a fairly nice price, is that the person hadn't done a good enough job of tightening down the heat sink. The transistors ran a little bit hot, and therefore the inductors, the chokes that were feeding RF energy into the collectors, the solder melted and they weren't making contact. So it was a fairly simple fix for me. So I do recommend you look around and buy an amplifier designed for 2 meters. Back with you for any further questions or comments on the above, Ray. KC2MMY, K2LIW, the TechNet.
That's Dick, N2EO. Could you put me at the end? I'm sorry to get in 808.
You're on the list, Rich, N2EO. And who was that mystery man who didn't give us a name? I just happened to know him. Go ahead. Ray, KC2MMY, K2LIW. You got it, Ray.
I can ask one more additional, an add-on to the same question, really. I want to exhaust my resources before I buy another item. So my only other option is I do have a 2-meter amp, but it does only FM. Is there any way to cheat and make it do sidebands? It's actually a dual band. It's a good amp, but it's no sideband.
Almost all afterburner amplifiers that are designed for FM service are really running Class C. That's a fancy way of saying that they draw almost no current until drive signal arrives, and that drive signal turns the transistor on and starts drawing current. There's many a person that's taken one of those FM amplifiers and fed single sideband into it, Ray. It's a little bit ratty sounding, but it does work. Lots of guys have done it. So I'm not recommending it, but lots of guys have done it. As long as it's not during a contest where the splatter you might create would give some grief to the guys that are 5 kc up the band and 5 kc down the band, they wouldn't like it. But as long as it's not one of those really crowded contest types, you could do it. So it's many a person who has written some articles. Let me drop this. Written some articles and how to take a FM indicated and FM designed afterburner amplifier running Class C service and change the bias network on the transistors to move it in the direction from Class C toward Class A or AB. In other words, there's going to be some standby current. If you don't apply that extra bias to the transistor, moving it closer to Class A or AB, the peaks of your sideband will come through beautifully. The valleys of your sideband, the low-frequency portions of your voice, will get cut off because of that Class C operation, where until you hit a certain amount of drive power, the transistor doesn't get turned on with the way it is biased. So therefore, you'll have what the sideband people call crossover distortion. Your low-amplitude portions of your speech will not come through. The high peaks of your speech will come through. So changing that bias network. Been a number of articles on how people have done that on various amplifiers, particularly KLM like amplifiers. KLM, let's say now, Mirage. Mirage, KLM, and other amplifiers. People have taken an FM amplifier and made a modification that drastically improves its class, its single sideband operation. Let me drop. And the peak power output might come down a little bit in that process. Or, in because the transistors are now on more continuously during the transmit, they're going to run a little bit hotter. Class A amplification is a little bit lower in efficiency than Class C. And if you really want to do the job just right, you're going to readjust the impedance match on the final stage a little bit. You'll get a little bit more power output. So modifying FM into sideband amplifier, absolutely doable. If you do enough web search, you will find articles of where guys have done that. And there's a medium good chance you'll find that your exact model number, a guy has written an article saying you change resistor R15 from 1,000 ohms down to 15 ohms, and you add this extra choke. We're not talking about expensive parts here. And so, very doable. And I recommend you do some search on that. And if you tell us the model number of your 2-meter FM amplifier, there's a medium chance that somebody will come forward and say, yep, I know where there's an article telling you how to modify that. KC2MMY, K2RAW, go ahead, Ray.
Okay, Dick, thanks for the info. It's the model that's really only 35 watts out FM, but both bands. It does the 70 centimeter band and the 2-meter band. I don't know what model, something B. But you're giving me a lot of ideas. Maybe I can parallel some resistor on the base and, you know, get some current going to the transistor, the input. Or just play with it and see. It's good information. I didn't think you could do anything with it, but now I'm getting some ideas. So I appreciate it, and I'll look that up. And if not, we'll just have to buy a sideband amp. The only other issue is a lot of them don't like more than 5 watts in. The ones that I'm finding that are cheaper priced, they like up to 0 to 5 watts in. I have a 12 watt radio, 12 watts coming out, so that becomes an issue. I have another radio that has 5 watts coming out, so I'm worked something out. But I just thought I'd throw that out there. All right, I don't want to take up the whole technet because I can do that. I appreciate it then. Thank you, KC2MMY, technet.
Hey Ray, you're in a hell of a lot better shape than you know about. You've got a 12 watt output sideband radio, and you've got an amplifier that only wants 5 watts input. That's the easy way. That's like a guy complaining about the fact he's got too much money. You're complaining you've got too much RF. Killing RF is easy, Ray. A fixed attenuator, about a 6 decibel attenuator between your transmitter and that amplifier will fix that immediately. Because that 2 meters, a piece of RG 58 coaxial cable has got something like 14 dB of loss per 100 feet, you only need a few feet of cable coiled up to go between your transmitter and that amplifier, and that will be the 6 dB high power attenuator. It'd only take up an 8-inch diameter coil, a few turns of it. And so once you select your particular brand name of RG58 cable, for instance, where the manufacturer has told you at 150 megacycles how many dB per 100 feet it's got, and you want 5 or 6 dB of loss, so that's a direct proportion. It might be 5 feet or 8 feet of cable, so to speak. You coil it up and put it in between, and that will be the loss you're looking for. On top of that, let me drop.
A6DPZ with a comment.
Hal recognized. On top of that, when you put any kind of passive attenuation between a transmitter and an amplifier, any of the normal methods by which the amplifier can break into oscillation, it becomes a hell of a lot more stable. When you've got an unstable amplifier and you put resistive attenuation on the input side and the output side, all of a sudden it calms it down. So it'll be a more unconditionally stable amplifier. It'll be happier with that attenuator. And there's a zillion ways of making an attenuator. I'll bet you Hal's going to give us a couple more. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW and the tech man, I want to say hi to everybody. It's K6DPZ. Well, the only thing I'm going to say is if you're using a transceiver and you're using it through the amplifier, it works passive and receive. If you put an attenuator in that thing, you're going to lose 6 dB on your receive side. So you better think twice about doing this. You have to attenuate only the PA amplifier. So you have to go into the amplifier, put your attenuator where your relay switches into the amplifier input. You do not want to degradate your pass going the opposite direction into your transceiver. That's my only comment, Dick.
Yeah, Hal's brought up a very good point. That 6 dB attenuator that I just mentioned does exactly the right thing on transmit, but when you go back to the receive mode, your antenna is now going through a 6 dB attenuator to get back into the receiver. It's not a showstopper. You'd just be 6 decibels less sensitive in this particular situation. So the close-in guys you'll hear, the far-out guys will sound a little bit too weak to you. And there are various ways of building a network of relays that bypass the attenuator in the receive mode. You can put an extra connector on your transmitter to do that function for you, where that connector is only effective in the transmit mode and not the receive mode. Hal recommends that your amplifier, and most of these afterburner, let me drop it. Most of these afterburner amplifiers already have a bypass relay in there. It is a double pole, double throw. Yeah, it's double pole, double throw. When you're in the transmit mode, the relay throws in such a way the signal goes through the amplifier. When you're in the receive mode, the relay throws in such a way that the amplifier is thoroughly bypassed. So within that relay, you can add extra connectors or whatever with a coax cable so that your attenuator is only there during transmit and not there during receive. So you might not even need to add extra relays. The relays that's already in the amplifier is what Hal's suggesting. With proper wiring, will do the job for you. I wonder if that makes some sense, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hey, Roger that, Dick. I understand. And, yeah, there's some things I can do. If it's worth it to do it. My concern now that you said all that is that if you can lose half your signal in 8 feet of cable, well, you're dropping 12 watts down to 6 or 5 with 8 feet of RG58 or what have you. How the heck can you get any kind of signal out of a 100-foot cable? So that you know, I would think by 100 feet, you've lost all your signal. And am I missing something there?
Not really, Ray. Lost all your signal. You never lose all your signal. I don't care if it's 1,000 miles of cable. You and I could calculate how much attenuation. What comes out of the other end is so weak, it's extremely hard to use. You never lose it. Whether you're behind a mountain and you're transmitting a radio signal, you're inside of a screen room and somebody's trying to talk to you from outside of the screen room, all of these things are attenuators. You can attenuate radio signals. You can never kill a radio signal. Ain't that crazy? It goes everywhere all the time. I mean, let's discuss this how strong. If you use no attenuator at all and found a way to tap into the 12-watt rig, which has an automatic gain control circuit on transmit, and you adjust that particular pot, so instead of putting out 12 watts a peak, it only puts out 5 watts a peak. That's a definite way to go. So now that's another method that many guys have used. In the case of 12 watts versus 5 watts, I wouldn't worry what I'm about to tell you. Let me drop. There are guys who will take a 100-watt output-capable rig, and by adjusting the automatic gain control and other circuits inside, they'll crank it all the way down to, let's say, 5 watts. And so, with key down steady state service, that works like a charm. However, when you go from the receive mode to the transmit mode, that first spike of energy until the automatic gain control circuit with that new setting takes over, you put out a 100-watt spike for a few milliseconds, and then it calms down to 5 watts. Well, with that bigger ratio, could do some damage to the transistor. In your particular case, something that's rated for 5 watts, which is probably a conservative number, and it would take 8 watts steady state and probably not have any damage, and a very brief spike of 12 watts is not going to damage that transistor. So in your case, turning it down, that's right at the transmitter, is an easy way to go. So you've got a number of solutions here. You've got more things as possible solutions here, Ray, than you knew about. Your hard decision is to choose the one that's best for you today, and you're allowed to change your mind tomorrow and use one of the other ones. Wonder if that made some sense, Ray. KC2MMY, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, KC2MMY with K2RW. Yeah, okay, I'm good with the solution to my problem, Dick, but my I guess you prompted another question, and which is, again, if you can lose half your wattage on only 8 foot of cable, what happens in a standard installation from your radio to your antenna when you're using 100 feet of cable? Are you then what ends up coming out the antenna if only 8 feet gets rid of half your signal? Let's say 16 feet is getting rid of 3/4 of your signal. So you know, I mean, attenuating it. So by the time you get to your antenna, and forget about what I'm trying to do with sideband, by the time you get to your antenna with a 100-foot piece of cable on RG58, how much signal do you have left from your original wattage? Back to you. And that'll be the last thing I'll bother you with. K2MM1.
Yeah, I'm glad you repeated that question, Ray. I intended to cover that in the previous transmission and forgot. On 2 meters, if you're going to cover 100 feet between the shack and the antenna on top of the tower, unless you really got your back against the wall and you got no other choice, you're not going to use RG58. There's cable and there's cable. You can use tiny, small diameter cable intended for 3 megacycle operation, and you can use it at 144 megacycles where you get a tremendous amount of loss, and you're on the air, but you're going to be free power and you're going to have trouble hearing. You're going to have a tin ear in the way of your hearing, and you're going to have a very weak voice, if you know what I mean. If you now switched over to 3/4-inch CATV hardline, even though it's rated for 70 ohm impedance, that stuff has got something in the vicinity of 2 dB per 100 feet at 144 megacycles, instead of 14 dB like RG58. If you're willing to go to 7/8-inch Andrew Heliacs, you'll get probably 1.5 dB of loss. If you're willing to go to 1 3/4, 1 5/8, Andrew Heliac, I think we'll get 0.3 dB of loss per 100 feet at 144 megs. So you choose the right cable, and the signal will get there, almost all of it. Choose the wrong cable, and it's a much higher attenuator. No matter what cable you use, you always... Let me drive. No matter what cable you use, Ray, you're always suffering a little bit of loss. But for a guy like you, with your resources, you have the ability to save your nickels and buy a better piece of cable, or go to eBay and buy it used, or go to your local stockyard for cable TV. And nowadays, they're using 1 1/4. And forget about the fact that it's 70 ohms. That 1 1/4 cable that's now in the stockyard, I'll bet you at 2 meters that has a loss of about 1.2 dB per 100 feet, some very low number compared to RG58. Yeah, semi-rigid cable is a little bit more difficult to deal with. You'll run it up the tower, and at the bottom of the tower, you'll transfer over it with adapters to some more easily flexible cable to bring it into the shack. And don't worry about the insertion loss of connectors and adapters. In order to get loss in a transmission line system, it takes length. Adapters and connectors have no length. They have no loss. That's the truth. You say those words on 20 meters on Saturday afternoon, and everybody will climb down your throat and say, what the hell planet are you on? Everyone believes every connector and every adapter has half a dB of loss. Absolutely crazy. Back to you, Ray. KC2MMY, K2LAW.
No, Dick, I never thought to check the cable. I'm going to check all my cables now. I took for granted that 2 meters would just travel the same as every other signal on a regular piece of RG58, and I never realized that that's something I should be looking at, because I might be losing quite a few dB there. I'm going to have to check that now. And, wow, how dumb is that? So I don't even know what I'm using. I just grabbed a piece of cable and wired it in. So we'll definitely look at that, and we might get some more signal out if I change that. So, yeah, thank you very much for that information. Next time, you know, I guess cable TV, like you say, cable TV, I don't know what the frequency coming in on cable is when, you know, they use that 75-ohm stuff, but it must be up in that range where it's will handle the higher... frequency. So, yeah, we'll check that out. Thank you very much for that information. KC2MM1.
Ray, you go to the right manufacturer's data sheet on all the brands of cable, CompSpo, Spec, and Amphenol, or whatever. You'll find a graph where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is decibels of gain, decibels of loss per 100 feet. And you'll see a whole bunch of lines across that graph at roughly a 45 degree up slope. And so each one of those lines represents a particular cable, small diameter, large diameter, expensive, cheap, whatever. You'll see a bunch of lines. So you go to your particular frequency horizontally and sweep up to that line, and it'll tell you how many decibels of loss per 100 feet. All cable has more loss at higher frequencies. That's why it's got that slant up at a 45 degree angle on that chart. And by the way, that crazy chart is a log-log chart. It's logarithmic frequency horizontally and logarithmic decibels of loss per 100 feet vertically. And with that crazy mathematics, the loss is a slanted straight line on the graph. So you can find out exactly how much loss your cable is giving you when you know how many feet, what frequency you're using it at. And your next question should be, why in the world would a nice piece of shiny cable give me more loss at higher frequencies? Let me drop it. And there's basically two reasons. One, the skin depth of penetration. That's something that we brought up a little bit last week. We're probably going to discuss a little bit more this week. In other words, how deep the RF energy goes down into the copper of the center conductor of your cable. It goes down less and less, only roughly 1/10,000th of an inch of the outer layer of that copper on the center conductor is conducting any of the RF energy per se. You go to higher frequencies, instead of 1/10,000th of an inch, it's 1/20,000th of an inch, if you know what I mean. Less and less of it is there, and therefore the resistive loss of the copper goes up with frequency. No matter what dielectric we use, no matter what kind of foam other than air, the foam has more loss at higher frequencies. So long cable, with rare exception, has more loss at higher frequencies. Slight exception within certain frequency regions of waveguide. And that's a complicated issue. We won't go there. So you have the resources to look up your brand of cable, find out exactly what you're getting in loss, and decide that, hey, if I lay down another $50 and buy a better piece of cable, I'll have twice as much signal coming out, twice as much receiver signal. I'll hear the TechNet using only 1 watt of transmission instead of 15 watts of transmission, if you know what I mean. You have that that resource, Ray, and lots of us have been down this road. Ain't it educational? KC2MMY, K2RIW.
Okay, roger that, Dick. Tomorrow morning I'm going to be out there checking the cable. You know, I just grabbed a piece of cable and hooked it up. It's about 100 feet, you know. Been using it. I'm getting some decent reports, so I'm hoping it's 75 ohm cable TV stuff. But I will definitely check that out on the internet and see exactly what the attenuation is. So back to the tech, man. I don't want to hog it. And answered quite a lot of my questions. I appreciate that. KC2MMY and TechNet with KTMRIW.
You've asked some very good questions that a lot of people have had or don't know that they should have had, Ray. Come back next week and tell us what you find and whether or not you decide to make any change. And, hey, John, KC2WG, sounds like we've got a fairly happy customer here. We've got to send him a bill. That's a joke, Ray, not to worry. Joe gets us into some pretty deep radio questions from time to time. Let's see what he's got tonight. W2RYY, K2RIW, TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. W2RYY. I have a comment and a question. The comment is on a question I asked several weeks ago, and that was how to test one of these HF balance. And I did take the suggestion that one of the gentlemen come up with of using a combination of different ohmic resistors on the output leg to get rid of the long piece of cable I had in place of it. And I can tell you the results I got. And it's still a little baffling because the thing still seems to have some bandwidth to it as far as the readings I got.
I'd like to hear about that one, Joe. The most severe test would be to put a pure, very short lead, 50 ohm RCO7 or whatever resistor on there. Make sure you're not transmitting an amount of power that's going to burn it up. put that on your balance, and on the input of the balance, see a close to a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio if it's a 1-to-1 balance. And then with an extremely short clip lead from the coax going into the balance, the shield, to either the left side or the right side of that 50 ohm resistor, connect that clip lead and see if the standing wave ratio changes a little. It will. Changes a whole lot. It shouldn't. It took me, I played back last week's recordings of the TechNet, and I realized that my explanation of a balance, as the evening wore on, it was getting a little bit more clear as time went on. In other words, to the average electronic engineer, a balance is a mystery. Let me drop it. And my best way of explaining it, and Mike WY2U sort of was backing me up on that, as a schematic diagram, if the balun was ideal, it acts like an isolation transformer. There's a primary winding where you're applying your energy into the balun. There's a secondary winding completely floating from the primary winding with no center tap to ground or whatever. Completely floating, secondary winding, same number of turns, primary and secondary. Almost nobody really builds a balun as a an isolation transformer, but you could. At least at lower frequencies you could. Electronically it behaves that way, and you know that you put your voltmeter across that secondary winding of a transformer while it's being loaded, you'll see the right amount of voltage. And if you grounded the left side or the right side of that secondary winding of a isolation transformer, nothing would happen. The load across that winding would see the exact same voltage, and the primary input current and primary input phase angle wouldn't change one iota. When you have a thoroughly floating secondary winding, isolation transformer is that way, and an ideal balun acts that way. So, and as the ideal balun, as the balun is less and less ideal, and that's a quantitative measurement, doesn't have to be qualitative. Mike, WY2U, Professor Mike was giving us a technique to come up with a quantitative answer. So let's see what you found out, Ray. Here we go, Joe. KC2, here we go. Oh, boy. I want to use everybody's call this night. W-H-O-R-Y-Y. K2-I-W. You know who you are. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, Dick. Well, what I used to repair resistors was something that was just obtained out of a local electronics store, and they didn't have a vast selection. So I used a 33 ohm and a 15 ohm. That gets me up to 48 ohms. That's as close as I can get to 50 ohms. I'm a little off, but I'm sure you, as you would say, it's not a showstopper. So this is what I got. I use a return loss bridge that's rated at least 1 meg up to 1,000, and I use my service monitor. Turn it off. And I started out at the center of the band, 15 megahertz, with the two resistors across the output connectors of the balun, two loops. I got a return loss of about minus 10 was about 3.1 meg. On the higher end, I could go up as high as 35 meg before I got, again, a return loss of minus 10 dB. Now, here's the interesting thing with this, what it did, because I was curious about this also. I went much lower in frequency, just because I intended on using this thing for listening to broadcast band reception for AM broadcast. And at 1600 kilohertz, at 1.6 meg, the return loss was minus 6 dB. And at 0.8 megahertz, or 800 kilohertz, the return loss is minus 3 dB. So it does seem to make some sort of difference as far as the frequency operation, and make something look like it has some sort of definitive bandwidth, at least between 3 to 35 megahertz, with 15 being about the best. And then I'll come back with a comment on the shorting on each of the resistors. Back to you.
What you saw, Joe, is very predictable, very close to what you should see. Although your balun is not wound that way, if it really was an isolation transformer designed for, let's say, the center of the 15-meter band or the 20-meter band, and therefore it has a certain number of turns on the primary and secondary, some number of turns on the secondary, very similar to what happens when you wind a 60-cycle transformer, and you better put some extra turns on primary and secondary if the transformer is going to go over to Japan and be used either in Europe or Japan, on 50 hertz power. As you go lower and lower in frequency, the same amount of inductance of a primary and secondary winding by the formula X sub L equals 2 pi FL, as you go to lower frequencies, the same amount of inductance becomes a smaller and smaller inductive reactance. So pretty soon the inductive reactance of the primary and secondary starts becoming a very low number at low frequencies, and now you could say it's beginning to short out that winding. That's an exaggeration, but that's one way of looking at it. So almost every balun that acts like an isolation transformer will fail in a predictable manner at lower frequencies, like what you saw. Minus 18 dB of reflection coefficient, let me drop. It's extremely good. I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's probably something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio, 1.3. The usual rule of thumb that people use as to what is a tolerable amount of reflection coefficient is minus 10 dB. Minus 10 or minus 9.7, I think it is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which in theory, in the worst case, gives you half a dB of insertion loss because of standing wave ratio. So any of the places where you're better than minus 10, you're in fairly fat city. So what you saw is very predictable on the low end. That's the way it should fall off. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, depending on how the balun is constructed, let me drop. The balun itself could be working like a charm up to, let me pick a number, 50 megahertz. However, when I take a 33-ohm resistor and a 15-ohm resistor and put them in series and put them across a balun, the pure inductance of that length of that load resistor with its actual leads is now starting to add inductive reactance to that 48 ohms of resistance you've got, and therefore you will see a standing wave ratio just because of the load imperfection, even if the balun was perfect. And your next question is going to be, with those two lugs coming out of a balun that's intended to go to the two halves of a dipole, and those two lugs might be 2 inches apart, how in the world can I put a perfect 50-ohm non-inductive resistor across that length? And that's another whole discussion. That's a bit of art and science. Let me drop. By placing that load resistor inside of a shielded coaxial structure, you can make a purely resistive resistor that has a whole lot of length to it, and the length doesn't result in extra inductance. You start taking apart a high-power Bird dummy load that's made for a kilowatt, and it's made to go from DC to 1,000 megs. You will see some of these techniques. There are ways of giving your resistive element lots of length so it can dissipate lots of power and not yet pick up extra inductance. But it takes fancy physical layouts to do that. With difficulty, that can be done, and that's a little bit of what I think you encountered on that. Now, the next thing you're about to tell us is that at various frequencies, you ground the center tap of those two resistors, you ground the left-hand end and the right-hand end, and there's going to be a whole lot of individual decibels of return loss that you measured in each one of those. I'm not so sure you should give us that data right now because I'm not prepared to handle it. Let me drop. Because Professor Mike did write to you, he was going to see if he could find that article that was being by the organization. They were required to make quantitative measurements as to the quality of balancing structures at various frequencies. With his set of three equations and three unknowns, where you plug in the reflection coefficient on each of the three connections of the clip lead at that frequency, and you plug those three knowns into these three equations, you then come up with a quantitative number for the quality of that balun, how well isolated it was. And so without those formulas, what you're about to give us is not so useful, Joe. It's good academic information. I'm not ready to handle it. I don't have those equations. Mike has to find them. So, and I'm sure you found results that are a little bit confusing along these lines. From my point of view, without those equations, you would have got a fairly good go-no-go test with nothing but one single 50-ohm resistor, and you do not ground, or then you ground the left-hand side, and then you ground the right-hand side. That, to me, is going to be the easiest data to interpret at this time. In fact, you did do that. Of the three ways you connected, I don't care as much about the center of the two resistors, but you grounded the left side and you grounded the right side. That is giving us some qualitative information. So go right ahead with that, Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the tech net.
Come in.
Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah. Okay. I went back to 15 meg, which seems to be about the best return loss, initially about minus 18, looking into the feed end of the balance. When I grounded the center of the two resistors, the 15 ohm and 33 ohm, the return loss only went down to minus 17. When I grounded the 33 ohm side or the 15 ohm side to ground, the return loss went down to minus 14. That's my data. I didn't check it on multiple frequencies, only checked it on one frequency, 15 megahertz.
Fantastic. So with no grounding, you had minus 18. One way of grounding, you had minus 17, the other way, minus 14. That's extremely good, because my threshold of grief is minus 10 in reflection coefficient. To make this a little bit more clear for people who are listening who have never heard of return loss in decibels, on a vector network analyzer, it's called the S11 measurement, and you can display that as a voltage or as decibels. Whenever there is a less than ideal load at the end of any transmission line, if it's a 50 ohm impedance transmission line, it wants to see a pure 50 ohm resistor and nothing else. Let me drop. So that all the signal goes down the transmission line once, hits that ideal dummy load, all of it gets absorbed by the dummy load, none of it reflects, and so now there's a problem. When the signal coming back is very close to zero, you would assume that the measurement would give you an answer very close to zero. If your instrumentation was measuring voltage or power, that is what you would see, something very close to zero in the return direction on the transmission line. However, a more high dynamic range method of displaying data is with decibels. And decibels have this peculiar mathematical characteristic. As you approach zero, the decibels become a very high negative number. Negative 10 dB, which really is something like one-third of the voltage coming back, is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 1.3 standing wave ratio, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it is a signal that is a tenth of a volt instead of a third of a volt, and that would be a minus 20 dB inflection coefficient when displayed in decibels. So when you're displaying return loss in decibels, the bigger the negative number, the better. If your return loss was really near zero because you had a nearly perfect dummy load, let me drop it. And if you had dynamic range with enough, if you had instrumentation with enough dynamic range, you might read minus 30, minus 40. I have read return losses on ideal setups as low as minus 60 dB. What does that mean? That means the return loss is extremely close to zero. As a power ratio, minus 60 dB says that the power going forward versus the power coming back, the power come back is 1/1,000,000th of the power going forward. That's what minus 60 dB is. You try to read 1/1,000,000th of the power on any reasonable power meter, and you're down to 1/100th of the width of the needle with a magnifying glass and a microscope. You're not going to see it. And the meter has a little bit of stiction to it. It's not even going to respond. Whereas if you've got a decibel display device, like a well-calibrated vector network analyzer, minus 60 decibels of display is easy for a vector network analyzer display. And it's telling you the return loss is so low because your dummy load is so good that 1/1,000,000th of the power is coming back. You see the advantages of decibels. It gives you quantitative data of huge ratios of forward power versus reverse power. So negative decibels of return loss, the bigger the negative number, the better. And so where you measured minus 18 with no resistor and with no clip lead, minus 17, which is damn close, minus 14, that's a very, and you calculate what minus 14 is as a standing wave ratio. Minus 18 may have been a 1.3, and minus 14 may have been a 1.5, if you know what I mean. So you're now seeing quantitatively what's happening, and that's darn good data. What if this makes some sense, Joe? Lots of people have trouble with near zero magnitudes, huge negative numbers in decibels. At first, it sounds crazy. The B2RYY, good area. K2RYW.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Joe.
Well, Dick, the reason I use decibels is very simple. Going back to my days working for T-Mobile of about 8 years worth of time, I learned very quickly that using decibels had an extreme advantage over using the SWR scale and the instrumentation, because the SWR scale is a linear function, and to get the machine to display a 1-to-1 to a 10-to-1 or a 20-to-1, it was very hard to do that, to get the thing work on one scale. Where if you change the scale to go into decibels, and if I calibrate the instrument that way with the precision load, precision short, precision open, I can easily see with the precision load of a reading of minus 54 to minus 60 on the bottom end of the scale. So if I took readings of different things using it like that, you'd have a much more you'd have a lot more sensitivity available to you. That's why I use decibels. I like decibels. It's also very easy to understand with decibels what's going on. Minus 10 is 10% return loss. 10% return is 10%, minus 20 is 1%, minus 30 is 0.1%. So you can do things in your head very, very quickly. You look at something, and you can very quickly see if you're good or bad as something goes. Now I have a question for you.
I'm ready for that question for you. And right into your question, then we're going to go over to Wes for his question on this subject. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, you can go back to the subject. The question is actually pretty simple, and it may require a broadcast engineer to answer it because of a little puzzle as to what I was receiving. I took my test instrumentation, hooked it to my television antenna, and was looking at the frequency range from 82 to 88 megahertz because I don't see that many TV signals coming in anymore on RF channel 6. And what I happened to notice was there's program material that I received at 87.74 megahertz running wideband deviation, at least 60 kilohertz of deviation, if not more. And then I went down to 83.25 and I could see a carrier, and that's what's a little puzzling. The carrier didn't match the audio as far as being in sync of so many megahertz away. I tried to receive the signal on my television set, putting it back in analog mode. I couldn't see any kind of picture. The service monitor told me that it had some sort of sync, vertical sync type of signal, about 60 hertz, on the carrier 83.25, but couldn't see any picture. The program material was like Oriental or something like that. I don't know if it was Korean, Japanese, Chinese, whatever. So I just say Oriental, but maybe your broadcast engineer personnel that come by here from time to time might have some information on what I was receiving. And it was coming from bearing about 280 degrees, so I believe that's probably something coming out of the New York metropolitan area.
I've got a guess on this one, and I'm going to go over to Eric. There are an amazing number of very low power, sometimes analog, sometimes digital, television stations scattered around the metro area. Many of them contain Chinese information, Spanish information. Those are the two main ones that I've seen. So that's my guess as to what you're seeing. Channel 6, locally, very low power, local area transmitter. And if they're running low enough power, sometimes these guys have even got special dispensation where they're allowed to continue transmitting analog for quite a period of time. They're not forced to go over to digital. Let's see if Eric is available to make comment on this one. KE2EJ, K2RIW, if you're there, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. I'm sorry I wasn't paying attention to what was being said. Was this station transmitting digital or analog?
Between 82 and 88 megs, he saw this signal, which did have a carrier to it. Joe, give us a little bit of a description. And the signal peaked up to his west 280 degrees. I'm guessing it's a low power local television station. W2RYY, K2RIW, describe that signal and its frequencies, Joe.
Okay, coming into my television converter off the antenna on the roof through its amplifier, I got a signal level on 83.25 megahertz of about -55, -60 dBm. The sound carrier was a lot higher in level by about 5 to 10 dB. It seemed to be approximately a little stronger, but it was not exactly the same ratio away. The sound carrier was at 87.74 centered. I could tell when the person who would stop talking, you see the actual carrier there, 87.74, and running modulation of about 60 kilohertz or more in deviation. And I thought the old NTSC standard is very like broadcast audio, something like 50 kilohertz on the audio part of the broadcast. So it made me kind of like mystify what I was actually looking at. It sounded like, you know, something below the FM broadcast band. I didn't know what I was listening to. And when I tried to tune the TV in analog mode to this frequency, the TV went slightly whitish, no picture viewable whatsoever, but it did have some sort of sync information on the 83.25 megahertz carrier. It looked like about 59.5, almost 60 hertz, the type of sync signal. Back to you.
You got it, Eric.
Okay, this sounds like Dick Bogner's experiments. Yeah, the station is sitting on top of the Citibank building. It's the same way for many years. He loves playing games. It's like my friend Jeremy up in Alaska. He makes it crazy. What he has done for many years is he's actually had commercial music services on Channel 6, the next thing up is FM broadcast then, and there are many different receivers out there that actually will tune slightly below 88 by one channel, which is just enough to get the audio. So, by the way, the picture carrier and analog versus the sound carrier, the sound carrier is supposed to be amp, so there you go. C2RWK,
Joe. So Ray, Joe, it looks like you found one of these experimental signals. It could also be a low-power, very local TV station. And it seems to have all of the characteristics of analog television, except the analog television audio is usually plus or minus 25 kilohertz maximum. The 60 kilohertz you saw tells me, like Eric is saying, it's either an experiment or I think by way of various means of getting stereo, other information on the audio channel, and or Muzak and things like that, I think the peak deviation for very brief periods might go beyond the normal 25 KC. Is that possible, Eric? Particularly if you're running low power, I think you can get away a little bit of murder on this one. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, stereo analog television is ETSC. So if you're transmitting mono, it's 25 kilohertz. So you get another 15, add what we call SAP or separate audio program, get another 5, add what's called the Pro Channel, which is if you actually listen to the Pro Channel on 15, ISBs for New York 1. Where the Pro Channels were generally sold or used within, like NBC would use their own for their own trucks. So yeah, it gets wider than 25 actually. It gets up to, with everything in it, I remember, I think it was like 40 or 45, something like that. Same thing with FM, it's not just 75. You put the subcarrier, add the other stuff, and it's bigger. Now with the digital on both sides of it, it's even bigger. K2RIWK, 2JAM.
The bottom line of all this is that if somebody makes what he thinks is a secret transmission on some frequency within 50 miles of W2RY's house, he's going to find you. Not much grass grows under his feet. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Well, guilty as charged. You're probably right on that. It was just a curiosity question, actually.
Now, Wes, N2XJN, you had a further question on the subject of return loss measurements with a Balun. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah. Well, the most of antennas are unbalanced even when they fit by balanced source line. So the question would arise, what makes the circuit balance? Into a jail.
If I was feeding the driven element of a Yagi antenna, the dipole-like driven element, and if it happened to be fed with a gamma match rod,